something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Goode, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
Came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello. This is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and I am your host, Liv. You know, that woman who's always yelling at you for something or other. And I am back here today with yet another incredible conversation episode. Today's episode is with Dr. Amy Pistone, a woman I have been following on Twitter for a long time and could not be more excited to finally have her on the show talking Greek tragedy. Amy studies Greek tragedy and women, amongst, I'm sure, so many other things, but those are the main reasons I wanted her to come on the show and talk and talk and talk. It is utterly my favorite thing to just sit down, we have a conversation with these incredible academics and just have them just speak for as long as humanly possible. It is the best. And today's episode started out about Greek tragedy in general, but when I found out that Amy really prefers Sophocles, I was so ready for somebody to give me the argument for Sophocles. I am always all about Euripides because I've just always found a connection with his plays, but I also haven't read a ton of other playwrights' plays. Like, I've read a few Sophocles and Aeschylus, don't get me wrong, certainly the major ones, but I haven't read enough to make a full decision on who I really do prefer. I just fucking love Euripides' Medea and Bacchae so much that I think I got just sort of pulled over to him for those reasons alone. So today's episode is all about Sophocles and why Sophocles is actually incredibly cool, writes complex characters, and has great plays that obviously I will now be covering on the podcast as soon as humanly possible. Honestly, though, any conversation about Greek tragedy is a great conversation, so I'm just so thrilled with this whole episode. It was so much fun to record, so much fun to revisit when it came to editing, and I can't wait for you all to hear it, which is, again, something I say for all the episodes, but it's just because it's always true. Conversations. Who's this Sophocles everyone's talking about? Sophocles and Tragedy with Dr. Amy Pistone. So I want to talk specifically, wherever possible, about Greek theater and tragedy because, I mean, when it comes to reading them, I do it obsessively, and like Euripides is my boy, and I could talk about him forever.
I have some thoughts about Euripides.
I also want that, please. Yes.
I can share my, because I was listening to your conversation with Emma, who I friggin' love. Like, they're super great, and we teamed up for a bit with reading Greek. I'm like not helping us get that, but and there were a couple. I was like, ooh. I just agree with some, like, I just like some people's opinions about like Euripides versus other tragedians. Like, I have some thoughts. So anyway, we can maybe get into that because...
No, let's dive right in, honestly. Who needs structure? So I talk most about Euripides just because I like that his women are people. And I've also read more of him because also there is more, but I've chosen to read more as well. But I'm so interested to hear your thoughts because obviously there's so much there, especially when it comes to what I do not know. So please, Euripides.
No, so when I started grad school, I thought I was going to be working on Euripides. And I got all the way, like, wrote the prospectus for, like, what I intend to write my dissertation on. And it was all about Euripides. And I was very the Bacchae and Medea were, like, the tragedies that really just got their teeth into me as an undergrad. And I really thought that was what I was going to work on. And then after a year of just making zero progress with my dissertation, I was, like, reading things and I just couldn't get any progress. And my advisor was like, I think the questions that you are interested in are actually better asked about Sophocles. And I was like, that sounds, I don't want to work on Sophocles. Sophocles is boring. Euripides is like the cool, sexy bad boy of tragedians. Like, you know, you got Aeschylus and he's like very, you know, authoritative. And I very much kind of bought into this framing that I actually think is Aristophanes' fault, which is kind of a sidebar. But I think from the frogs, like, he talks, you know, he sets up this dichotomy. And I think I just kind of bought that hook, line, and sinker. And when I started working on Sophocles, I actually think that Sophocles in some ways is more, some of what he does with gender, I think, is actually kind of cooler than, I think a lot of Euripides is very flashy. Like, it's very on the surface. And it's very, I don't know, almost sort of like edgier, right? He's like really throwing stuff in your face. Like, oh, the gods are dicks. And, you know, we got women. And like, I think it's a lot flashier, but I think actually when you start to dig into Sophocles, there's some really cool stuff. The female characters are in some ways like really interesting, but it's a little bit below the surface, and it's very easy to read him as like, he's just a traditional, he's not making any waves, he was friendly, and he was just like kind of the neutral in between the poles of Aeschylus and Euripides. And I actually sort of have come around to, maybe just because I spent several years obsessively reading Sophocles, but I have really come around to thinking that possibly Sophocles is doing cooler things, more like complex and nuanced things with some of these kind of questions about like what are these tragedies trying to do. And I actually do sort of think that Sophocles might be more interesting in some ways.
I love that. I think I needed that. So what a perfect lead in. Now, one thing, so I mean, I only first read it, The Frogs, last year.
for the podcast. And one thing, if I'm remembering right, is it that Sophocles hadn't died when he started writing it, so he had to write it about Euripides and Aeschylus? Yeah. So what do you think would be different if he had not necessarily picked Euripides or like had this fight between Aeschylus and Sophocles instead?
So that's such an interesting question. Yeah, if Sophocles had been really like available as an option when he was framing this whole thing.
Yeah.
Because so sort of famously, we never know if these are made up anecdotes about people's lives or not, but Sophocles was made a general for having like something was so cool and so civically great about the Antigone that they were like, we must award you with civic honors and we'll make you a general. And so I think he has a reputation in some ways, at least, of being very, I don't know, sort of patriotic or kind of traditional in his value. So I don't know, even if Sophocles had been in play, like, I don't know if Aristophanes would, it's just not as dynamic as that kind of superficial reading of Aeschylus as being very traditional and Euripides pushing all the boundaries and overthrowing everything and being this kind of like chaotic nihilist sort of energy coming in. And so, yeah, I don't know what that would look like if you put Sophocles in, because I mean, sort of the caricature of Sophocles in the ancient world, there isn't such a clear image that we get, partly because no one's fighting with Sophocles. Like, you know, Aristophanes clearly enjoys engaging with Euripides. And no one that survives, at least, is a rival of Sophocles in the way that we get like barbs going back and forth and we get people making comments and things. Like, that's just not there. So I don't know how you caricature Sophocles if you're your Aristophanes. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's such an interesting idea if he wasn't kind of this tacked on afterthought of like, well, and Sophocles is here, but he's fine. He didn't want to fight with Aeschylus, so he's just hanging out.
Yeah, I forgot it is kind of thrown at the end where it's like, oh no, because he is dead now, but it's not about them.
Yeah. I think it's such a clever way to like, no, because he would fight with yeah. Euripides, sure, but he would never want to go up against Aeschylus. So he's just chilling. He'll just watch and it's not a big deal, which is like, I think a very clever way to, because otherwise people are going to be like, what about Sophocles?
Yeah.
He's down there too. What about him?
Just so fascinating, all of those different, I like thinking about how they would have, you know, actually felt about each other and like those little, I think I learned more and more about Aristophanes just in the way he like, I think caused a lot of trouble for Euripides going like down the line, even like, you know, I don't know enough about the argument that Euripides is like not a feminist, but also I know that it all comes from Aristophanes. So, or like a lot of it, maybe I'm wrong there too, but.
Because this is one of those questions, especially like my students always like, you know, is Medea a feminist play? And like, did Euripides write it intending it to advance the kind of things that we talk about when we talk about feminism? Probably not. I don't know. But
no.
I find that not a very interesting question where, you know, like what, I mean, I don't think Lysistrata is like a feminist play per se, but that doesn't mean you can't still do cool, interesting feminist things with these texts. I think that's one of the things that's so cool about tragedy is that you get people you can take this story and take it in so many different directions and how you stage it is such a big deal. Like, you know, I mentioned, I was listening to your conversation with Emma and, you know, their choice to make this really about like genderqueer and non-binary and like, yeah, like that's, I mean, I think that's totally there in the text. But there are other things, you know, if you play it differently, there are ways where you can see this as being about family more, about, you know, that it's there's so many different motifs and that you can kind of pull different ones up to the surface. So I think you absolutely can stage a Lysistrata that is in some sense a feminist play. And, you know, you can treat Medea that way. But like, was Euripides trying to advocate for women to be equal parts of the democracy? Like, no, probably not. But
no.
But also, you know, were women actually running around being like, I can't believe Euripides blew our secret about that we're all terrible. You know, we're trying to kill our husbands. I can't believe he told everyone. Now it's so much harder to do this. Like,
no, and I think for me, because I definitely get that. The, you know, there's only so much you can put on to these people who would have had completely different ideals and like different, completely different, you know, thoughts on what even, you know, was progressive you know, for women, but for anybody. When it comes to Euripides, I find I connect with him and I like think of him in my own feminist ways, not to say that he was, but specifically just because the women tend to have like personalities and are complex and often like dark in a way that I like personally. Not necessarily that I think like Medea is a strong and powerful person. I mean, literally she was, but like,
yeah, technically, very much, yes.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, at the same time, there's some darkness there. But I think I love her just because, I mean, I love that story in general. I just think it's, I have no issue with reading a story about a woman who kills everybody because I think it's great. But I also just love that she's like this real human in a way that I haven't seen that much elsewhere. That said, I think I read Antigone too many years ago now. And, you know, I haven't read a ton of Sophocles other than like Oedipus. And I think Jocasta doesn't play nearly enough of a role in that. So then I'd get stuck on that and all these different things. So, you know, I think I also, like, I'll admit that I haven't given Sophocles a fair shake just because of that. Yeah.
I would say and I am always beating this drum, and there are people who strongly disagree with me on this, but one of my very favorite plays is The Women of Trachis or the Trachiniae. Mm. And it, for a long time, wasn't something that, like, people just didn't work on it very much because they felt like it, like, wasn't Sophoclean, because what people saw, and this is one of the things I think is so fascinating, like, what people see in these plays, because you had a lot of kind of mid-1900s, like, a lot of I assume fairly wealthy, like, white dudes, like, upper-class white dudes, and they, like, they were obsessed with this idea of, like, the Sophoclean hero, and we have all these people, like, the heroic temper, and there's all these about, like, it's the man who stands up against society and society can't handle that one heroic, and it feels very like something Aaron Sorkin would write, of like, you know, like, yes. And I love, you know, he's written a lot, but like, he has a very clear model of what the hero is, and it's a man who says the things and
very fast,
and, yeah, says it very quickly while walking around.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe a woman gives him something, yeah, and she says exactly. Hi, she says something nice, maybe she winks.
Yeah, she's a chance for him to develop his character a little bit. Yeah, and she pieces back out. Yeah, exactly. and the Trachiniae isn't that, and it, so people just kind of like didn't work on it as much because it didn't fit what they thought the Sophoclean hero was, and I think that was one of the things, that was the first play I started really working on of Sophocles, and it's such a cool story because A, you have Deianira, who is, so this is after the labors of Heracles, and and so he's coming home, and there's this prophecy that he's going to, and this is what got me, I worked on like the languages of oracles and how they're like tricky, and like why are oracles in Sophocles always super tricky and always misread, was sort of the like governing question of my dissertation.
Okay, well, we have to talk about that more.
Well, and I love that, like, because, you know, he was buddies with Herodotus, and you get like similar, and like, I just, obviously I can never prove this, but I like to imagine the two of them just sitting around talking about confusing oracles and just like, you know, drinking some wine and being like, oh man, like, here's a cool, like, what if we did like a riddle, like, could you imagine like a riddle version, that'd be cool.
I love that so much.
Right? just like two bros geeking out about riddle oracles. But like the thing that so Deianira, there's this prophecy that at this time that's coming up, there's like a deadline coming up, and like at this time, Heracles is either going to have an end of his labors or he's going to die. And so he's like coming home, and she's like, "Oh, super cool! He's not going to die because he's alive. So it must mean that he has an end of his labors now." And so she takes these actions, thinking because he's coming home, he's bringing a new woman home, and she's concerned. So she has this like love charm, she thinks is a love potion from the centaur that Heracles killed. As one knows, you traditionally give someone a love charm when their husband has just murdered you, so it makes perfect sense that mm-hmm.
Yeah, especially centaurs. No,
centaurs are generally very helpful,
amorous people as well. Yeah.
And so she has this, he's like, you know, take this blood, and like, if you ever need like a love, you need like a filter, like a love charm or something, you know, put this on it, don't let the sun touch it. And she's like, okay, just like remembers this. And so then, because she thinks Heracles is safe, she puts this love potion on a robe and sends it to him. And there's this whole conversation she has that I love, because she's like, I don't want to hurt, she's more or less like, I don't want to be like a Clytemnestra or Medea, like, mm-hmm. I just want him to love me, like, I want our home to be good, he's coming home to me and our son, and I just want to take actions to make sure that our home, like, he's gonna fall in love with me. because the love potion allegedly will make sure that Heracles will never love any woman more than you. And the twist on all of these is like, well, he can't love any woman more than you if he's dead. And the only rest for his labors is that he's dead. And so like dead is the secret answer to all of these little riddles. But you get this, like it's such an interesting treatment because she's like agonizing over this. And then she realizes what she's done and she's tormented by this and she ends up taking her own life. But there's this kind of play with like, she's almost looking at these other mythical versions. She's like, I don't want to be those women who killed their husbands. I just want him to love me. And she ends up killing him anyway. You know, she lights him on fire, like, which is possibly worse than these like other tragedies, right? Like that, like giving, like axing someone to death in the bath. Like, I mean, A, he very much had it coming, but B, like it's a pretty, like Heracles is on fire for, so then the actor who played Deianira becomes the actor who plays Heracles. And so you get that like that's the doubling in this play. Mm-hmm. And Heracles is like in the like the register that's almost only women use, like this like super emotionally elevated register when he comes in, and he's just on fire in pain for the second half of the play. So like, and it's such like, it's, I just think it's such an interesting look at like the cost of heroism, right? That like, that you can't keep that violence out there, like that, you know, the violence always comes home with Heracles, like that you can't turn it off when you come home. And what does it mean to like not want to be that kind of woman? And like, she becomes that kind of woman anyway. And so yeah, I think if you like complex women and sort of dark, in like, it's such a great play. And and I love it extra because so many people were like, this isn't good Sophocles. So yeah, I would highly recommend like read the Trachiniae. It's so fun. It's so good.
Well, now I'm going to, and it's definitely going to be an episode of the podcast. The best thing about this, I every once in a while I think like, oh man, how many more years do I have, you know, in terms of content? And then I'm like, there's just so many plays I haven't covered, let alone all the different, like everything else. Lord, it's just, yeah, it's endless. So I'm excited to have that on my list. I also want to dive more into Heracles in general because there's so much more. Like I've basically learned the labors and the sack of Troy, and I'm like, there's just so much.
There's so much. Yeah. Like, and because you're digging into the Argonautica now, right?
I'm just reading it aloud at this point.
I love Heracles so much. And I mean, just for a million reasons, but I love Heracles so much in that play or in that the epic because it's so clear that Jason can't be a hero if Heracles is around. Like narratively, you just have to get rid of Heracles because he's like way too much hero for Jason is such like a mediocre. Like they're like, who's going to lead this? And he's like, I don't know. Should we vote? And people are like, this is your quest, dude. You have to leave. Like, the fact that he's just like not like we at the very least, we have to get Heracles out of the way or Jason's never going to be able to be the hero on this quest.
And even still, I mean, no. He's still not a hero.
I taught the Argon. I have a lit survey class and it's like my students come into it like, oh man, like Jason and the Argonauts, this is going to be great. I'm like, I would temper your expectations because like it's a really cool as a work of literature, but like Jason, if you want like traditional hero adventure story, like Jason just ain't it. And
yeah, not at all. And the Argonauts even are like, the Argonauts are kind of it more than he is, but even still, it's just like a series of landing on islands and like briefly fighting people before they get to Colchis.
Yeah, it's I think it's just such a fascinatingly weird text, and I don't work on Hellenistic literature as my thing, so this might be like people may tell me I'm terribly off base, but I think of it as, it always strikes me as such a flex by Apollonius that he's like, I like, anyone can write an epic about like a cool hero, like anyone can write an epic about your Odysseus or your Achilles or your, like, watch me write an epic about the most underwhelming dude you've imagined. Like that is how good I am at writing poetry, that like I can write an epic about the most average kind of hero. Like it feels like it's a poetic flex more than like the plot is very much this kind of like not super heroic, like Medea's doing all the work for him. And you know, I think it's so interesting as a text because it's such not a very good hero story.
Yeah. No, I'm really interested in it more and more as I get through, because like I sort of skimmed it to do the episodes a long time ago, but I hadn't like read it word for word. And I just got to the part where Medea is like charmed by, like, or just like, you know, forced to fall in love with Jason. And I just didn't realize it was going to be quite so heavy handed in that, like, this is not Medea's choice, like, yeah, at all.
Which, I mean, I think just in terms of like the flex of like to write a prequel essentially to Euripides, mm-hmm, and to be like, watch me make her truly sympathetic. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, you know, you can go back and forth on Euripides, Medea, like how you feel about, I'm very much team Medea. Like I have no problem with what she did. And but, I mean, that's another thing that always comes up with students of like, no, this is bad. Like, okay, but have you never watched like a revenge movie? Like, have you never watched a Tarantino movie? Like, there are things that we allow in fiction. Like, it's satisfying to watch someone just burn it all down. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean, you know, I don't think superheroes should go out and do like vigilante shit in real life. But I can let that happen in a fantasy world. And like, yeah, I don't think you should light people on fire because you've been disrespected. But is it really fun to imagine, like, to see that happen as like a hypothetical? Like, is it great to watch like a really good revenge plot work out? And like, yeah, of course it is. And
yeah, it's so satisfying.
It's so satisfying. But like, I love that, like, because my students after, because we read Euripides first, and then when we get to, and like, I have a lot of students who bring up the question of like, if she didn't have, like, is she still not acting of her own volition? Like, by the time we imagine, like, her story ending in the Euripides version, mm-hmm, of this world, like, is she in control of herself, or is she still being controlled by the gods? Because, mm-hmm, if she doesn't have any agency, like, if she's being used as, like, you know, the intensity of her passions, her inability to, like, let this slight go, if she has been supernaturally made to fall in love with someone, like, how much can we even think about blaming her for her actions? Like, is she still under the influence of this? And yeah, I think he does such a good job of making her really like this, her as book three, I guess, where like she's tossing and turning. Like, I mean, it's just such like angsty teenage crush of like, she's going, then she throws herself on the bed and then she's like, no, I should go talk to her. And like, I love that scene so much. Like, Medea in Jason and the Argonauts is just such a compelling, interesting character. And like, and you know, then you have to reassess how you think about Euripides' Medea of like, mm-hmm, if this is like, do we understand how she got from point A to point B? And I don't know, I just love how much it makes you kind of rethink what you may have thought when you read Euripides.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I feel about just like reading into all the different texts, but then also like having conversations like this, you know, like there really is so much you can dive in and like examine in these characters. And that's, you know, that's even like just on the surface of the text for the most part what we've been talking about. And then there's the whole other level of like the things that aren't in the text or didn't survive or whatever, which is a little like, it doesn't apply as much when we got the plays, which is kind of nice. The plays are like a one thing, you know, and it's like it is a start to finish thing that we have, and that's kind of satisfying in the midst of all the rest of the mythology. But yeah, I mean, it's so interesting to have that other side of Medea, and then like written so much later. Well, not, I suppose not that. I mean, it was enough later.
But like substantial, yeah.
It's a couple hundred years, relative, I imagine. But I know. I've been trying to think about that more and more, like drill it into listeners more and more of like, because I think, especially when you're not in the world of classics, it gets a little bit lost where, you know, the sheer volume of years that come in between so many of the sources that we know.
And so many times, you know, like Ovid is our first like version of a story, where we have like a coherent version of a story. Mm-hmm. And like, how much was that known before versus how much is Ovid playing with it? Because a lot of times, you know, the like Metamorphoses is like our first, really lays out some of these myths like beginning to end. And so, mm-hmm, you know, maybe that version was out there before, or maybe he's doing his own thing, and we just don't know a lot of times, where, because it's our first attested version, but we have vase paintings that maybe allude to this version of the story, so can we maybe date it earlier? And you know, so then when you're looking at these texts, like how much of this is Euripides' innovation or Sophocles' innovation, or versus how much of this is the story that's out there and everybody knows, but we just don't have any evidence of how common that version was.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then for Ovid too, but especially with the playwrights, you think like even what you're saying, you know, comparing it to the superheroes, we're like, you know, they'll take a story that exists, but then they're, you know, making it into a fictional play. It wasn't on them to keep to a myth that people knew. They were going to play with it intentionally. And but then now, so often what we have is the play, and so we have to base our knowledge of a myth on a play, but how much of the play were they just totally fucking with in order to make a good story or to like shock the audience or so many things? Right. And I just love those questions so much.
Yeah, because I mean, I love how much we have these superhero stories, like that there's so much superhero-ish kind of movies and TV shows and things right now, because I mean, I love selfishly because it makes it so much easier to teach students about Greek myth as well. Mm. Because yeah, you know, when you have a Batman, like, are you, do you have like a gritty Christopher Nolan Batman who's like, oh, I gotta find Harvey Dent or whatever, and you know, or is it like a real campy Batman, and you don't know, you know some basic stuff. He doesn't have parents, he something about bats, whatever, he's got a lot of money. But how you play with the elements of that character. And then, you know, you get some of these things like, I don't know, The Boys on Amazon or something, or mm. Watchmen, where we're taking those tropes and we're inverting them and we're playing with them. And I think it's such a, for thinking about what like satyr plays might have been like, or for mm-hmm. thinking about, you know, some, doesn't show up a lot in comedy or extant comedy, but you know, for thinking about what it means to kind of like play with these stories and okay, imagine the collateral damage of superheroes. Like imagine the people who just live there and like aliens invaded and their house got flattened. Like, is anyone paying for their house? Like there's going to be a lot of people who are mad at these heroes. And I think getting these stories that kind of play with the whole world of implications of when you have people who are larger than life, what does that look like for everybody else? And mm-hmm. so, yeah, I think the like explosion of superhero media has been so great from, you know, I don't have to spend as much time explaining to students. I'm like, but who was really somebody's father? Like, well, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Don't think too hard on it.
That's just not the right question to be asking. Like sometimes, yeah, you know, do you need them to be descended from a god or not? Like we got different versions. Do you need an Odysseus who's like somewhat divine back far enough or not? Like, you know, well, Use the version you need. It's fine.
Well, yeah. And then thinking about the way it affects everyone around, like what would it be like to live as a person in Thebes when, you know, there's a lot of shit going on because of a little something that's going on in the palace that nobody really knows about? Like, but then the people on the outside. And yeah, I mean, not to say that Oedipus is necessarily a great comparison to a superhero, but I think he's close.
But kind of, right? I mean, he's like, because I feel like one of the things that kind of defines superheroes is like they have a thing, right? Like you can talk to fish or you can run really fast. But like kind of most superheroes, like you have a thing. You're super strong. You can see through walls, whatever it is. And, you know, Oedipus's thing is that he's clever. He's smart. He's a riddle solver. That was what got him to, which I think is the thing that's so beautiful. I mean, again, this is me coming back to my like obsession with like cryptic riddling things. Oh,
please. I was going to do that the same. So,
but like his heroic thing, we don't have really any evidence that he's like a great fighter or anything, because his heroic shtick is that he can solve this riddle. He saves Thebes because of his intellect and because of not just being smart, but being like a flexible, like a clever thinker. And so, I mean, I think that's the beauty of his inability to see the answer to the riddle, right? His inability to see that the prophecy that he got was really fulfilled. It's the same mechanism of solving a riddle that you need to, the thing that you think it means isn't what it means. So, you know, you said you're going to kill your father and sleep with your mother, and you thought you knew who mother and father were. And it turns out, oops, you have the wrong things in mind. And the same deal, you know, the riddle, if we think it's the like what walks on four legs in the morning version of the riddle, like everyone thinks it's talking about an animal, it's talking about a human. And so that's that like shift you have to make to solve it. And it's like such a similar shift that he would have had to make to understand the riddling thing he got from Apollo, mm-hmm. and his inability to apply his like that. I think that's what makes it such a beautiful tragedy, because like it's his heroic thing. He got brought down by the thing that he's best at. It's not like something like it's so heartbreaking that he just use the thing that got you became king because of this. Just use that same thing somewhere else.
That's such a better way of looking at it. I find that very interesting, because I've always kind of come at it of like, why the hell could you not figure it out? You know, or like, well, you heard a rumor that the king and queen of Corinth were not your parents. So why did you not like run with that rumor or look into it a little bit? And like, maybe we'd have saved ourselves like this whole story.
So like, if I can do like a real nerdy deep dive on it.
Please.
So what? The wording of what he heard is that his father isn't his father. Mm. And I think, and I don't know how many people agree with me on this, but I think he thinks they're saying his mom was a slut.
Oh.
So I think he hears that. He's like, and he mentions So I love how much, because when he tells this story, at least by the much later point when he's telling this story, maybe he's retconned his experience a bit, but he mentions, like, at a bar, someone was drinking and they said my father wasn't my father. And I think, like, we hear it and go, like, oh, honey, like, oh, you were so close. You were so close to figuring it out. But I think he thinks someone is calling his mom a slut. And
yeah, just an insult necessary before it is like necessarily
it's at a bar,
like,
and someone's insulting you. Yeah. And then you go to Apollo to, like, get out, you know, figure out what the deal is here. And you get this horrifying prophecy. And I think part of it, like, it's such a natural reaction to having said, is like, I have to get as far as possible away from my mother and my father. And so, like, this, most of the steps he makes are pretty understandable. Like, yeah, don't kill a dude at the crossroads, especially a dude who's, like, old enough to be your father. But, you know, he's angry. He's been insulted. And I don't think that we're really meant to judge that too harshly. Like, I think the idea of killing someone at the crossroads for, like, crossing you and insulting you, hitting you and stuff, I think he shouldn't have done it, but I don't think we're meant to be like, well, you're a murderer, so you have all of this coming. Like, I don't think we're meant to judge it that way. And so you get this, like, it's perfectly reasonable. And then he gets to this place and he does this cool thing and they give him a prize and he accepts the prize. And he seems, and I'm a much more sympathetic reader of Oedipus than a lot of people are, but I think he's been a pretty good king. For, like, it seems the people seem to like him. It seems like he's been a pretty good king, except for, you know, the fact that he's causing a plague inadvertently. But I didn't mean to. Yeah. Like, it was, and I think that, like, that's one of the, like, it makes it so heartbreaking because he's kind of doing the as best he can at every individual juncture, but he just keeps taking these steps towards this inevitable, horrible realization about himself. But he's kind of doing the best he can at those junctures. You know, like, yeah, is he a little angrier than he should be? Does he get a little defensive when there are suggestions made, like when Tiresias has some stuff to say? Yeah, like, he could have handled some of this better. But it's also not that unrelatable. Like, if someone, you know, if you truly think someone is kind of trying to come for your throne in like a monarchy kind of system, you know, it's a concern. You do not want someone to have, like, to overthrow a king and become a tyrant and all of that. So I don't know. I think he's not so bad. A lot of times people see him as this villain, and I think he is deeply sympathetic.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever necessarily seen him as a villain so much as because I covered Oedipus at the very beginning of the podcast, which, you know, I want to do it again because of all the ways that I'm better now. But I think at the time it was so much easier to focus on just how, like, obvious we can see it is, you know, that, like, he just should have realized all of these different things for all these reasons. But of course, like, that really, you know, that isn't, like, a fair argument on it. I definitely don't think he's a villain. I mean, the road rage thing, I think. Yeah, I mean, I don't think that we're supposed to think that that was all that bad. I mean, shit happened on the roads, you know? And, like, you know, this is an ancient world. Theseus killed literally everybody on a road, just one walk.
And
for,
nothing,
you know?
He takes a brief little stroll and kills everyone he meets, and he's fine.
Yeah, he gets fine. The biggest hero ever. Hero of Athens. But yeah, so, you know, that, I mean, that's definitely not supposed to seem like the worst thing in the world. It's just so interesting the way that it's become, you know, something I think quite different, mostly beyond the world of classics and into the world of, like, I mean, the things that Freud has done to the story of Oedipus and so many things there. But yeah, I mean, he's sympathetic, even if you see him as a dummy who should have realized all of these things that, like, should have been obvious to him, you know, because he's still sympathetic in the way that, well, all of that shit's pretty fucked up, you know, like,
Sophocles very specifically, like, this is another one of my, like, low-key obsessions about reading tragedy, is, like, the versions of the stories that are repressed, right? There are versions where the line of Oedipus has, like, ancestral guilt that his grandfather rapes a young man and that there's this inherited guilt. We get zero mention of that in Sophocles. Mm-hmm. And I think it's significant that he doesn't bring any kind of, this is what happens when you, you know, the the house of Atreus, right? They have this inherited guilt, and there's going to be more bloodshed because they are dripping with guilt. And Sophocles very specifically leaves that out in telling his version of Oedipus, where it's just, why is Apollo doing this? You know,
yeah.
It's not that Oedipus deserves it. And so I think, and the other, I mean, this is one of those things. So I wouldn't say, like, you know, sometimes people read him as the villain. There was a production of, it was by Theater of War, and they did a reading. They did a lot of readings of tragedies that were kind of, they do a lot of like anchoring them to current events, and the idea of leadership in a time of plague. Mm. And you know, which, you know, you can make those connections for sure. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people were reading Oedipus as sort of a Trump figure who like didn't want to listen to it. And I think this is one of the things that I think is so cool about tragedy. Like it can be a very valuable jumping off point for discussing what leadership in a time of a public health crisis looks like. Sure, that's there. I think you're missing a lot when you read for that. But I think hearing the audience talk back afterwards, and people were asking questions, and it was, I mean, almost every single thing was about, like, you know, how is Oedipus like Trump in ignoring what needs to be done to deal with a crisis? And I think that is not totally fair to Oedipus, like not seeing things that are right in front of him. Who among us has not seen things about ourselves that we don't want to see? Like, and I think, you know, it's blown out to, like, you know, it's magnified to a huge extent, but the experience of not recognizing something icky about yourself because you don't want to see it is like extremely human.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's all very human. Yeah. To not see that very obvious thing, even just, you know, in basic, I mean, even with the riddle stuff where you're right in sort of linking it to the Sphinx too, of just like the thing. You know, there is just needs to be that one little tick of change for him to get it, because it's just to like understand the phrasing, like whether it is just that it sounded like an insult on his mom or just simply that like it just that part's true. Just switch it, you know, and then like if you got that, then you'd be fine. But it's not. Yeah, it's not. It's more so that just it's not his brain wouldn't get him there, which right. is so often. And you know, it's like the number of times you'll ask somebody a question and they tell you the answer and you're like, oh fuck, like that was so obvious. Yeah. You know,
but I do that, god,
right? Like yeah, it's so that happens all the time, I think, for everybody. Whereas yeah, it's just that when we're looking at it from a play that's become a thing, and again, like become a thing because of this idea from Freud that like all of this he knew and it was all subconscious and he intentionally like married his mother, all that, you know, that's all bullshit. And but it influences the way people understand that story. And so then you like kind of immediately judge Oedipus in this different way because of that. I was going to say too, that when you're talking about the like inherited guilt too, because there's also the whole, and it is my job to bring up Cadmus at any point that where it's possible.
I'm contractually obligated to mention Cadmus.
It's a pure requirement of myself. But there is the whole like, idea of the curse on their whole line, right? Which is like really vaguely in a few myths, but is never fully laid out. But in theory, that whole line is cursed, and therefore, like, I don't know how many down the road Oedipus is meant to be. But the idea of that there just is a curse in Thebes, like between Semele and Ino and Actaeon and all of these people, that all this horrible shit happens. But it's not like the curse of Atreus where it's all linked back all the time. It's an interesting one where you can just lay it all out and there's like some vague references, but ultimately it's like really disparate curses or disparate like fuck ups in people that then, you know, if you read a couple little things, you can link it all back to this like line of Thebes. And I just have to talk about that line of Thebes all the time.
No, well, and one of the things that I wish we had would be more of the Theban cycle of epics.
Yes.
Because like there's so much we get, yeah, just these hints at things. And especially given how much Thebes often functions, you know, it's the not Athens. And so like, God, I would love to know what more and versions of the story of Thebes that aren't coming out of Athens, right? Because it's the anti-Athens in Athenian tragedy, which is obsessed with Athens. And thinking about like if we had more accounts of stories about Thebes from Thebans or Spartan, you know, that just knowing what it looks like, because all of our ideas about ancient everything is so biased by the fact that it's predominantly Athenian stuff that survives. Like our literature mm-hmm. is so like Athenocentric that I would love to know what those stories look like when you are not using it as a foil to talk about your own civic identity and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Thebes is such an interesting one, and they have this whole interesting like series of myths, but yes, other than a couple plays that are Athenian and therefore like talking shit on Thebes in whatever way, sometimes specific, sometimes not, you know, other than those, we really don't have much. But like you're saying, we know that there was a Theban cycle. Like I would give my life for it. I mean, Cadmus and Harmonia are like the reason I'm in this whole world, and that like 12 years ago, I started writing a novel about them, and then
and then
became this person that I am today, who's still trying to finish that novel, but also is now like deeply involved in mythology. And before that, I literally had just like I just liked it, you know, and then I researched that and was like, okay, cool, I'm gonna get a classics degree. And then now we're here.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So is there, I mean, I feel like this is a perfect opportunity to be giving Sophocles more airtime than I ever do.
I am happy to geek out on several more Sophocles things.
Please. Yeah. So we've talked about Women of Trachis and Oedipus. So what other Sophocles should I be giving a chance to that I haven't?
So the one that I think, so like, because I think like Oedipus, Tyrannus, or Rex, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, and Antigone are the one that they mostly, the thing that I kind of love about the weird, like, and it's just a weird coincidence, but like the fact that we have these two titles, right? Oedipus Rex and Oedipus Tyrannus. Mm-hmm. And it's just like a weird convention of, you know, the Greek and the Latin and whatever. But like Rex properly is like Basileus. Like Tyrannus is a different thing. And it's not exactly a tyrant per se, but it's a different thing than a Basileus. Like a Basileus is an inherited position by and large. Mm-hmm. Rex is an inherited position. And it's weird because Oedipus starts off, we think, like he's a tyrannus. Like he's a ruler who's come from outside and he's become the ruler. And it turns out by the end, we realize that he is the Rex. He is the Basileus, right? So that his act, like his legitimacy or his authority, why he's ruling, it turns out he is actually the ancestral king. Like he's the son of the king. And so I think it's such a weird, like when people, you know, we go back, like, what do we call this play? And I love that, like, between those two titles, that's actually the entire hinge of the play is like, oh my God, we thought he was a Tyrannos. He thought he was a Tyrannos. It turns out that he was a Rex the whole time.
See, that's extra interesting. I jump to it specifically because I'm like, why are we using a Latin word? But I love to hear about it in that way because, yeah, of course, like there, it's not like there's only one word for like that type of king in Greek. So
yeah,
that's so much more interesting.
So yeah, I think it's such an interesting, because a lot of people like know it as Oedipus Rex and like, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably the more commonly used version. But
I'm like, why? But I have my Greek versus Latin issues,
right? You know, I usually like, you know, if for a classics audience, like, for, you know, I'm usually going to call it Oedipus Tyrannus. But yeah, if in a more broad, like if I'm just talking to like going to a high school or something and talking, I'm usually like Oedipus Rex. That's what they're familiar with. But yeah, I do love that those two titles, like just by like dumb coincidence. I mean, I don't think there was any intentional thought about that process when they were like, what will be the Latin name that we use for this? But that it gets at that tension between like why is Oedipus the ruler here, and what claim to authority or what claim to legitimacy does he have? And that it turns out like, oopsie doodles, he was actually the proper king by a certain measure the whole time, even though there's everything about him being king is also extremely improper.
Yeah. No, that's extra fascinating. Also another human who says oopsie doodles or variations on that word, and I respect that. I also talk like I'm 85 sometimes.
Yeah, I also say heavens to Betsy sometimes. I got that one from my mom, so yeah.
I say good grief a lot. Mm-hmm. Which I feel like is another a good one like that.
Yeah, though also very Charlie Brown.
But so Sophocles plays.
Yes, Sophocles plays. So I feel like Antigone gets a lot of airtime, and I love Antigone. I was a dramaturg for a production of Antigone that we did here. And I love Antigone, but because Antigone gets a lot of airtime, I'm going to leave Antigone to the side.
I think that's good. She's got a lot, and she's great, but...
She's great, but, like, you know, it's not hard to find out things about Antigone. But I will say the production I was a dramaturg for was Jean-Henri's version, which is, like, a very different interpretation of it that I think... And there was another college in town that was doing, like, a version of, like, Sophocles, Antigone. And so having those two, like, within a week of each other, we brought the cast together and did, like, a little conversation about the different – how the characters look different between the two productions, which I did think was super cool.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so I'm trying to think what would be my next favorite. Might be Philoctetes. So Philoctetes and Ajax often get lumped together because they both kind of deal with the casualties of like casualties, the side effects, the peripheral damage
PTSD
done by
type.
Yeah. And so people use them a lot. The theater of war uses both of them as like PTSD kind of things. But the thing, so one of the things that I love about the Ajax is like, yes, you get Ajax as this, like, I think very tragic though. Like there is, to be fair, he is trying to kill all of his fellow soldiers. So like motivation, but like, you get there's so many like little interesting things about it. Cause so he kills himself halfway through the play. And the second half of the play really is about Tecmessa and Teucer. And it's about the people that got left behind. And I think that is a really interesting, when we think about like the peripheral damage that war can do. I think it's really interesting from that perspective, because you have his had been a enslaved woman. She seems to, it seems to be something closer to a wife, but not exactly, mm-hmm. you know? And so, I mean, how we think about that relationship is complicated, but you get this, I think, really poignant look at what all of the other people that are hurt by suffering or hurt by violence, that are hurt by these kinds of things. And I also love that Athena is there, and you get this, like, the Athena-Odysseus relationship there is so interesting, because you, in fact, get, like, Odysseus has to be like, shit, Athena, like, tone it down. Like, you are relishing in this man's pain too much. Like, and I just love those moments where you get mortals commenting on, and this was something that came with, like, with the Bacchae too, like, you know, or your boy Cadmus being like, yeah, like, we fucked up. I get that. But this is not an appropriate response. And because we get so much of, by and large, like, we get these depictions of the gods, like in Euripides all the time, of like these gods that are just assholes. And they're outside and they don't care. And like Hippolytus, you get so much of this, like the two gods, like it's just pawns that they're like playing around with people for their own benefit. And, but I like, sure, the gods are dicks. Like that's a message to, like, that's fine. But I think when you get those more nuanced engagements with like, yes, like I know we like to see our friends do well and our enemies do poorly. Like, I get that, Athena, but this is not good. What is happening here is not good. And so I think that's like a really interesting moment in the Ajax. But yeah, I think I'm going to say the Philoctetes is my favorite out of the two, though. So for the Philoctetes, you just because not everyone reads these plays, I'm do super quick synopsis.
And I haven't covered either of these, so that's okay. Perfect.
Yeah, I didn't want to be like rehashing too much. No. So with Philoctetes, he's been left on Lemnos because he got injured, and his friends didn't like how much he was complaining about it. And it smelled bad.
He got a snake bite, right?
Yeah. And like it's festered and it's this wound, and his buddies didn't like the smell and the complaining about it. So they just leave him on an island. And it's so then, but like now they need him. Now there's this story, and like, you know, speaking of like repressed myths and the things that don't get mentioned, you know, Homer never talks about like these weird magic things. Like, he's not a huge fan of like weird magic stuff. And so you get kind of most of these things that seem to be like they're part of the epic cycle. The idea that there's the magic wooden statue that you got to get out of Troy for it to fall, like the bow, that you can't take Troy without the bow of Heracles, which Philoctetes has on Lemnos. And like these weird, they're kind of more, almost more like folktale items, these like magic items that help our heroes do their thing. Homer seems to not like those. You just get a few weird moments of like some talking horses, or Aphrodite has this magic kestos, like the little magic little girdle belt thing that Hera uses to seduce Zeus. But with very few exceptions, like all of the magic shit about Troy, like Homer doesn't want so much magic stuff going on. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so here we get this version where like they got to go get the thing. And so you have Odysseus and Neoptolemus are coming to try and Odysseus really wants to trick, because of course he does, really wants to trick Philoctetes.
He's a little dick. I love him.
Yeah, he's like, this is great. We're going to have a whole, like, we're going to dress up and we're going to pretend. It's going to be great.
He's such a fucking asshole, and I love him so much.
And like Neoptolemus is like, I don't feel great about this. Like, we have marooned this man. And like Neoptolemus is a monster. Another, like, he is,
I was
like,
going to say, yeah.
Like, not, but like he does, this version of him seems to have inherited a lot of Achilles being like, so I love the moment where they have the delegation comes to try and talk Achilles into coming back to fight. And Odysseus, like, he just clearly has no time for Odysseus. Like, I hate, like, the gates of Hades, the man who says one thing and means another. Like, Achilles does not like this, like, tricksy, like, maneuvering. And he's got fancy words. He's covering up what he means. And so I think, like, this Neoptolemus has inherited a lot of that. Like, he might be, like, violent, and he's a, you know, he kills Priam on it. Like, there's a lot of really monstrous things about Neoptolemus. But this version, at least, is like, I just don't think we should trick a dude that we abandoned on an island to steal his thing. Like,
weird.
So you get, like, this kind of, this tension between, like, do we Do we try and persuade him? Do we lie to him? Do we ask him nicely? Like, what are our options here? And I think it's cool for a couple reasons, because one, you get this, it's kind of a mythologizing, like it's putting into the myth stage the tensions around, like, what are we doing about the fact that some children, like, you know, this anxiety around like the sophists in Athens, like kids are learning to be deceptive, and that seems like a problem. So you get this kind of Odysseus as the representative of people who are learning how to use fancy words and learning about rhetoric, and they can convince people of bad things because their words are really pretty. And then you get Neoptolemus, who's like, I don't know if that's great idea, but you know, the entire war rests on this. Like, they do need to get the bow. And so what, you know, do you take a chance that maybe you can do this in an honorable way, or are you just like, fuck it, we got to do what we got to do, let's just like hold them down and take the bow and run. Mm-hmm. And so like, you have, you know, I think one of the really cool things about the play is that you wrestle with those kinds of questions so much. And like, Neoptolemus and Philoctetes end up like having a conversation. Philoctetes is like, this is like, so the word for bow and the word for life are basically like beyond bios. And there's kind of this punning between, he's like my bow is my life. Like, I have survived on this desolate island because like I can hunt for stuff. Like, I really need this bow. Like, my entire livelihood, like my ability to keep surviving on where, remember, y'all stranded me. Like, my ability to not die here really depends on this bow. And then, so at the end, it's our only extant Deus Ex Machina ending for Sophocles. And Heracles shows up, and he's like, you know, he sets it all, and like, the kind of Deus Ex Machina, like, hero, deified, apotheosized hero Ex Machina.
Yeah, he's a god.
And so he shows up and like sets everything right, and we live happily ever after, and we're going to heal Philoctetes. He's coming with them to Troy, and like, we get a happy ending after this. But it's right up till the ending where everything gets like miraculously put. I go back and forth on how I feel about the ending, because it's so heartbreaking. And the fact that we get this like very forced resolution to it just doesn't sit great with me, because like, up until that moment, it's probably the tragedy that just gets me right in my feels the most, because like, Philoctetes, it's just brutal, like what has happened to him and how he's been treated. And a lot of times, like, people use this sometimes as a way of talking about people not doing right by veterans when they come home from war, of like, and you know, people, some of the same thing with the Ajax, but he has not been done right by, and now they're going to take his bow, and this is not right. And just that, like, that agony about the awfulness of the world, it feels unsaid. And this is, I think, one of the reasons why I am not always as big a fan of Euripides, because the sort of nihilism, or just kind of the bleakness of like, the only, like, we have made a mess that's so big that only the gods can fix it. But then they do. And that's not how life works, right? And I think Sophocles' plays a lot more kind of force you to sit with bad things. Like, they force you to sit with the suffering. And the play, I mean, all of tragedies for the most part are so much about how do we, like, you never get to see the action. You never get to see people getting ripped to pieces, or people, like, none of the violence ever happens on stage. What happens on stage is people figuring out, what do we do when bad things inevitably happen, when unimaginable horror inevitably happens? Like, how do we respond to that? How do we go on? How do we pick up the pieces when things are so bad? And so I think I'm not a huge fan of, like, it's nice every now and then. And I think I originally was like, oh man, it's so edgy that like, we got these, you know, making you look at like it just feels a little bit sort of almost nihilistic on some ways. And I think one of the things that I do love about Sophocles' plays is, so at the end of the Trachiniae, after like, Heracles is maybe going off to be apotheosized on the pyre, but we don't get to see that. That's a more, you know, we probably are thinking that he's going to become a god, but we never get that resolution. We never get that conclusion. And then either Hylas, his son, or the chorus, like the last lines are, there's nothing here that is not Zeus. And just like, man, like, there is a god who ostensibly controls the universe. This is his son. This is just all happening. And I don't know, fuck, what do we do with that? Like, that ending, I think, is such a more powerful ending, as opposed to, you know, we all trot over to the pyre and then Zeus like yells down from a crane, like, my son, you're a god now. Yeah. Like that is not like, even if we know that's going to happen, like I think Sophocles doesn't give us that consolation or that resolution a lot. And I think that's one of the things in terms of like, as someone who is watching these plays or reading these, like that, then you walk out of that story and have those conversations with like, could this have been avoided? I don't know. Probably not. Like some of these stories, there were things you could have done differently in different places, but some of them are like irresolvable conflicts. Like by the time we get to the point of the play, things have already been set in motion. Somebody made a mistake. A god was mad at you, or whatever set the situation in motion, your ancestors made a mistake. But by the time, like there's this inevitable move towards pain, towards anguish, towards suffering. And I kind of love that Sophocles makes us like really sit with that, because I think when you have an ending that ties up the things a little neater, I think that's just not what, you know, I mean, it's nice every now and then, but that's just not how life works. Like things don't get magically tied up and fixed most of the time, or at least not without an awful lot of work from people. And so I think the fact that Sophocles leaves you with the, like, can this be fixed? If this kind of pain, like how does Hylas go on? His mother has just killed herself. His father is lit on fire, and seemingly Hylas has no expectation that Heracles is going to become a god. So he's just sitting there dealing with this. And I think that's one of the kind of beautiful things, as much as like, I love a good tragicomedy, like Alcestis or the Helen, like I love those in for different ways. But I think one of the things that's really cool about Sophocles is that he does make you kind of stare into the abyss a little bit. Mm-hmm. But the other, just a cool, so people, I don't think this is how Sophocles intended this play, but a cool thing that some people have done in modern stagings of it, and it's possible. I just don't think it's how Sophocles would have had in mind, but you know, it doesn't really matter what Sophocles had in mind.
He's been dead a while.
There are people who treat, so at the end, Heracles shows up and like, you know, here, give him the bow, we'll go to Troy. There are people who suggest that, because I think the actor, it's at least possible that the actor who played Odysseus played Heracles. I don't know if we know for sure. Some plays, like, we know for sure who doubled, and I don't remember if we know for sure with this one, but it's possible it was the same actor. And there are some people who want us to see this ending as Odysseus dressed up as Heracles at the end. And so that, like, instead of like the forthright, like Neoptolemus winning the day with his not wanting to deceive Philoctetes, that we are meant to see this as Odysseus dressed himself up like Heracles to get the bow, because like he's like trickery did win out in the end.
Yeah.
And which I think is such a cool, just kind of thinking through that. Like I said, I don't think that's how Sophocles would have originally staged it, but it's such an interesting twist to think about, you know, what if this is like, because Odysseus is so tricksy. And like, I remember my mind being absolutely blown the first time someone pointed out to me that there's no external corroboration for any of the stories that Odysseus tells. His men are all dead. There's no witnesses. There's no evidence. Like, we have no reason to think that that the Cyclops and like that any of these things happened, because he could just make that up.
Oh yeah. No one else ever saw the Lystragonians.
Yeah. And the stories are so neatly, like, it's such a good ring composition that it does kind of make us wonder, did he just make all of this up? Which is like, people divide into like, are you an Iliad person or an Odyssey person? And I just love how much the Odyssey never gives you firm footing that, like, maybe he had all these traumatic adventures, or maybe he just ditched his men and was like, whatever. And it's telling the story that will get him home. So he's crafting a story that, or his men died, but like in a much less dramatic way, but he is telling these stories that subtly emphasize all of the right things to make sure that he gets good hospitality and he gets sent home safely. And like, I love the, just how convoluted and how unstable the plot is, you know, we have no idea what's going on, which is kind of the experience of everyone who ever talks to Odysseus. Like, are you telling the truth? It sounded plausible, but like, it would sound plausible. You're good with words.
That's why I love the Odyssey too. It's just, it's so messy. yeah. in this way where it's also not messy, but it like it inherently is. And yeah, I'm an Odyssey person.
Yeah, definitely. I very much yeah. like I have come around more to the Iliad than I used to be. Talking to people who really love the Iliad. I'm coming around, you know, I'm seeing more things than I used to see in the Iliad. But
yeah,
I just love, I'm very much an Odyssey person.
Yeah. The Iliad's amazing and it's so beautiful and, you know, it is, yeah, it's an incredible work. But the Odyssey is just so many things. It's just so messy and weird and Odysseus is so ridiculous. So yeah, I love it. But it's so interesting what you're saying with the like deus ex machina or lack thereof too, and I think it's probably the plays that I focus on and the ones that I've read, you know, in the last 5 years, but I never think of Euripides as being particularly into deus ex machina because, you know, I love Medea, in which case, like, you know, that just turns that all on its head where it's just she shows up in a dragon chariot and flies off with dead children.
I love that she is her own deus ex machina because I think of it very much as being like she is her own deus ex machina and like this, like, you know, this elevation to her is like almost a divinity. Like I love that play so much.
Yeah. Well, and that ending, yeah, it's unreal. And so, you know, I don't think of that as a traditional deus ex machina because I agree. I think she is it. And in that way that is so like visceral of, you know, this is the whatever you want it to be or whatever it was, you know, in that moment structure wise. But it is a thing that is used for the gods and Medea is showing up with her dead children and using it. And I love that. And then I don't really think Bacchae has much because the dais is in the whole play. and so it's just, and like, I think Phoenician women now, I'm trying to think of, I did that one recently, but I can't think of whether there's much in there. So I just think my brain doesn't go specifically to it, but it's because of the plays that I focus on and specifically just Bacchae and Medea are the ones that are like live inside my head. But that's so interesting to see it that way. And then but I can definitely appreciate that. It is much more interesting to sit in what is happening than have the god come in and just like, okay, that's all clean and good, which is sort of, I mean, speaking of Odyssey, that's kind of how I see Athena in it too. Oh, in absolutely. So many ways. Yeah, she just is that, just rolls up and like, okay, well, let me just fix up everything that's gone wrong for you and I'll just make it all better.
Which I, like, so this is not about tragedy, but the last book of the Odyssey I think is so interesting because like I remember when I first read the Odyssey in high school and you know like the hero's journey was like the kind of thing we talked about, but like it's not, we might think it was like a traditional like happily ever after, and then we get the last book where like no, this is a mess and it's not, people are not okay with what he did. He slaughtered like a Everyone. Generation of men and he took a whole generation of men to Troy with him and they didn't come home, so like this is a real problem. And, you know, we get to see like the suitors in the underworld being like, I don't know what just happened. Like, and I think the fact that we get this kind of subversive ending, I just love about, because it unsettles. You're like, oh, okay. He made it home and he got rid of the bad guys. And then that we get to see like the other people of Ithaca and the suitors in the underworld being like, yeah, that's not great. Like that it takes a god to come in and fix it. Like it very much makes us question how much this is any kind of like happily ever after story.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I mean, my brain immediately connected that in a very separate kind of way to the end of the Iliad where, you know, I mean, I think it's, and I don't know any of the details on this, but they really are such different epics.
Like, oh, so much.
In so many ways. But still the idea that, I think the Iliad throughout really does give you the idea that we're not supposed to be siding with the Greeks, even though it's about them. But the end really clinches it. And I don't remember if it's in the last book or if the last book is just the funeral games. But I think it is the last book, the Priam?
Mm-hmm.
Priam coming? Yeah.
I think so.
But just ending, yeah, it's at least very close.
Yeah, very late books. I think it's 24. It could be 23.
I feel like it's much more powerful. It's 24, so I'm going to assume.
Let's say.
Yeah. But yeah, like ending with that where it's like, okay, we've hinted at it to you that like the Greeks are not heroes here. They're really fucking shit up for no good reason. But here's the end where it's like, here's the tragedy of a father who really did nothing wrong, whose son did nothing wrong, whose city did nothing wrong. And it's just all a mess. And everything's just at the hands of these like warmongering Greeks who just like rolled in to fuck shit up. But yeah, it's a similar, I mean, I feel like that's a connection I've made between the two in a way that there's not a ton of connections in my mind between them suggesting, you know, one's a sequel or the other or written by the same person. So but this idea that like it ends with like, hey, was any of this good? Were any of the people you've been following, were they good? Or were they all sort of like messy and either liars and murderers or just like angry and murderers? And anyway, I love the Odyssey and the Iliad, clearly. I just don't need, I end sentences always like that. Like, I just fucking love it.
I just God fucking damn it. Love this. Because one of the things I was thinking about while I was listening to that conversation about the Bacchae, about how much, like, where we see ourselves in the story, like, is one of the things I just love. I mean, about myth in general, but also tragedy specifically, because I think I was thinking about Medea, and Medea is a play that I have, like, in different ways related to over, like, just over years of reading it and being in different places in my own life. And mm-hmm. like what you think, because I think a lot of times we like, what is this play about? And, you know, it's a story of, and like, if we bring it down to like, what is the central, you know, Antigone is a story of the, you know, obligations to the family and religious obligations versus obligations to the state. Like, that's what it is about. And it, what we think a play is about, I think is so interesting because it has so much to do with like where we see ourselves in that story. And, mm-hmm. you know, so like Medea, it was the first play. I was in a myth class and it was a breadth requirement. And someone said something to the effect of like, bitches be crazy. Like, was sort of they were like, you know, how do we feel about this? And mm-hmm. I was just coming out of like a nasty breakup, and man, did I like whirl around on him and have some words about, I was like, first of all, I don't think she did anything wrong. And second of all, like,
she was fully in her right mind too. Like, that's something I think to make very clear. Yeah. About Medea, in that she knows exactly what the fuck she's doing and she's doing.
Yeah.
It.
And like, that was kind of the moment when I was like, I have never cared this much about my, like, I was an engineering major. Like, I've never cared this much about what I'm doing in those classes as like I have just by like lighting that. Like, if, you know, if this is a thing that you can spend your life doing, is engaging with these texts that have me like so fired up. Like, maybe I should do that instead. But, you know, so like years later, I was living separate from my partner, and I said I had a job at Notre Dame, and, you know, and the thing that really jumped out at me was how, like, I was very like sad and kind of resentful about like what academia demands of people. You're moving every year and you're giving up so much of your life and you're away from your family on the job market. And I was just like in a real, and I was reading Medea for teaching a class. And like the thing that I saw in it was like someone who gave up so much. She left her home. She gave up so much, her family, her this, and for what? Like that, and that kind of anger and that rage about being asked to give things up and not feeling like that was valued, right? Which is like not something I'd ever seen in Medea before. But at the time, I was like, oh, this play is about my anger at contingent job market and academia. And, you know, which like is literally 0% what Euripides would have intended. But like, I think one of the things that is so cool about these, that where you are and where you position yourself in the myth, and like, because myth is flexible enough to do that, that you can like, you know, oh, I feel like I am this character in this moment, and this story is a really valuable way, like thinking about how many people get like mythology based tattoos and things that like I have Atalanta on my thigh, like how much these kind of flexible stories are a way that we kind of metaphorically can talk about our lives. And I think that's one of the things that is so cool about. And so when you see these different versions of tragedy, like who is Helen, right? Like, is Helen this person or is Helen that person? And that you are telling a very different story about what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a pretext for bad behavior by other people, what it means to have agency over your own story, what it means to, you know, that these stories can be the story of, because it's so friggin' weird. I love Euripides' Orestes, like, because it's just a disaster of a play. Like, it's a mess. It ends with like shit is on fire, and Apollo shows up and is like, you marry you, and I guess we're good here. Like, it's just a disaster of a play. Like, I love it because it's so messy.
Emma was telling me about that too, and I haven't read that play since university, and now I'm obsessed with reading it again because they said such similar things to that, and I'm like, okay, shit, I can't. I was actually in a radio play recording of Orestes.
Oh my God.
In university. Yes.
I've literally never seen anyone perform it at all because it is so like, because the plays that I have been any part of are like very normal. Like we did a Hippolytus and, you know, been involved with some Antigone, like, but like very normal, like traditional yeah. plays. I've never seen anyone perform the Alcestis. I've never seen anyone perform like Orestes, like, because it's, I gave my first like academic conference paper on the Orestes, and like it's so weird.
Yeah, and I don't remember that part. I just need to, like, I don't remember it being that weird. I actually could have sworn we did Electra in the radio play, but I like reached out to my prof a couple years ago because I wanted to get a copy of it, which I'm still hoping to get. And he assured me that it was Orestes, and I'm just like, I could have, because I played Electra, and I was like, I could have sworn that I was the lead, but like, whatever. I guess I was the second.
Because like Orestes spends most of the play being like, he is very much like, he's maybe it's like a mental health, like psychosis. Maybe it's something mm-hmm. like that. Maybe he's being pursued by the Furies, but no one can see them, which again, like,
right.
as opposed to the Aeschylus version, like the Euripides version, like, is this all in his head? Are they hallucinations? Are they delusions? Or can just no one see the Furies because they're only pursuing him and they're not visible to everybody? And like, we never get an answer to mm-hmm. that. Whereas like Aeschylus tells, like the humanity, like they show up, they're there and they look scary and whatever.
Yeah.
But it leaves it like really ambiguous whether, you know, he's having symptoms that, I mean, it's symptomology that shows up in like our Hippocratic of madness, of, you know, and you these are symptoms that are like connected to physical ailments in mm-hmm. in our Hippocratic corpus, but like we kind of don't know what is going on, like, look, you know, how we're supposed to read it. So he's very unwell, and he's kind of coming in and out of cogency because mm-hmm. he's hallucinating about the Furies, and so Electra's kind of doing the most of the,
yeah, so maybe that's what it was.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean it's kind of the lead. But I love, like, just this is one of my favorite Helens of any, like, of any, because you get this beautiful line, like, Helen's there, and like apparently we're supposed to just get over the Trojan War thing, and Electra clearly is not over Helen, like she's just no fan of Helen, and she's like, what, as evidence for what a trash person Helen is, she's like, you know how you're supposed to cut your hair when you're in mourning? She like trimmed it so she'd still look cute. Like that's Helen. And I just love it. Like it's such a petty, especially when you compare it with like, you know, with like with the Helen, where she's so clever and she's so smart and she's savvy, and she, like, she's a victim of this entire situation. The gods have been mm-hmm. using her for dicking over everybody. And then you get, like, you know, by the same author, this Helen who is like, doesn't want to mourn too much because that she won't be cute if she's getting too into the mourning. And I just love the distance between those two, like the same character, but like such different versions of yeah. what she is.
Oh. See, and this is why I love Euripides. But you've sold me on Sophocles too.
Give Sophocles a chance.
You've sold me on his merits. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, I do really like part of it also, that kind of the selection bias of like, we have a random sampling of Euripides, like an alphabetically just whatever.
Alphabetical, yeah.
Whereas like for Sophocles, a lot of the plays that we have by Sophocles, like were because they were super popular. Whereas like we do mm. not have the most popular plays by Euripides. We have the popular ones and then just like H's and I's and whatever.
Yeah.
Like, right. Like, so I think our sampling bias is so different because these were not like ones that were intentionally preserved as like the greatest hits of Euripides. Whereas
I know, just luck.
Like, yeah. So, but I do think when thinking about like what it's like for the average people around, like that's one of the things that I've started really thinking about with the choruses, because the choruses usually are like the random normal people, and like, with, you know, people get really hung up on like, is Antigone right or is Creon, you know, and Antigone's like doing what the gods want, and the gods do like co-sign what she does in the end, like the Tiresias is like, yeah, the gods do not like what you're doing, Creon. But like, I find Creon so much more sympathetic when you think about it from the Theban's perspective, that like they bear, like we just had what is effectively a civil war, right, in the Seven against Thebes, and now this fucked up family, like, is like, how many generations of Thebans, like normal Theban people, have to die? We got the plague from Oedipus, we got a civil war, like now he's trying to like put some semblance of order back in place, and you're willing to risk it all for your brother? Like, could you just take the L on this one and let the city be like, and I think that's such, you know, and that's, it's not ever anywhere explicitly in the Sophocles text, but like that idea of like the chorus is going through it, and like it's always the elites, it's always the powerful families that are doing all of this stuff, and just normal people have to suffer the consequences. And I think sometimes that gets lost because the plays don't necessarily direct us to look at the plight of the average people there, but you know, the chorus is like average citizens would have served in the chorus, like performed as chorus members. And so, and like, I really have over the years gone from being like, I don't know, choruses are weird old, like little song and dance interludes, I guess, which like is, you know, it's like classics undergrad. I was like, I don't get this chorus stuff.
You get to like skip through it because you just want to keep reading.
Yeah, yeah, I want to get past it. Like, let's go.
Yeah. But like, this is too much reading.
Yeah, this is, I don't understand what's going on. There's like some rivers I've never heard of doing something like. But I think the, when you think about that, like that was the place where, and like, if you've served in, if you've been in a chorus, you also are sort of qualified. Like, I think you would judge the choruses a lot more because you're like, I know, like when I was in the chorus, I hit the choreography and like Steve over here, like can't do his dance moves for shit. Like, and, but like that also that's, I think that's the place where the audience is identifying, you know, that that's the closest link to the audience, whether or not we think like the chorus is the internal audience or they're this or they're that, but like, That is the place where like physically that is the only seat you've actually sat in the play. You've never played Oedipus. You've never played, you know, Jocasta. You've never been the elites. You have only ever been the marginalized characters, the old women, the old men, the enslaved people. Like that's the only role you've ever played. And I think that would matter in terms of how you are thinking about, you know, you're leaving the theater being like, yeah, I kind of don't like that the super rich, like the generals or the this or that, like we're, I guess we're going to Sicily for an expedition. Like no one asked me how I felt about that. Like, you know, how come I have to go do this because, you know, some of the rich people in the city, some of the powerful people, the elites want us to be fighting this battle. Like that, I don't know how I feel about that. I kind of think like, it kind of feels like they're being a bit of an Agamemnon right now and I'm not a fan. And so like, I think that like the elite individuals who are making problems for everyone else and the everyone else who has to deal with the consequences of decisions that they didn't get to be part of making, I think is like a really salient part of how these things work. So yeah, I think the chorus has become a much more important part of how I think about tragedy over the years.
Yeah, I found that generally, just like the more I pay attention to it, the more I realize quite how important they were, but I've never thought about it in that way of just like the average person. I think that's so important. I also didn't realize that like average people would be in the chorus, which is adds to that, because I think inherently the chorus is already like the voice of those people, but then if they were actually in it as well, like that's huge.
Yeah, I wish I ran the numbers at one point about like, you know, if we're assuming not too much over, like roughly what percentage of the Athenian populace at any given time would have probably, like just to get an estimate, and like it was a lot higher than I thought it would be when you imagine that, you know, you're doing, you got three tragedians or, and you know, they're training the chorus, and that's, you know, that like the chorus is getting paid and it's like a like civic duty, and you know, some rich person is funding it. It's one of their like the liturgies. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it being this kind of like, it's not quite tax dollars going to support, but it's something, you know, sort of akin to that, that like the state is insisting that we need to pay and train citizens to do this thing. And that it's like, it's kind of a religious thing, but it's kind of a civic thing, but it's kind of, you know, and that, so I think that idea, the fact that you have the population coming to this thing that is also like, you know, your friends in a play, you're gonna go watch them be in the play, you're gonna go see how they do, and you're gonna pay attention to that part, whereas like our main, like our three actors were professionals, and they get more professional as time goes on. So people who do like a great falsetto that can play, you know, in the same way that like for Shakespeare and stuff, like you need men who can play compelling women. And so yeah, I think the chorus is really a place where, as much as we can tend to gloss over it, like ancient audiences, I think, would have been paying a lot of attention to the chorus. And we have accounts of like during the Peloponnesian War, people who were prisoners of war like got treated much better because they like could sing the latest, you know, like the latest Hamilton song or whatever, you know, like they had the latest chorus. And that there was some real cultural currency there of like, oh yeah, I went to that play and let me sing the third choral ode from whatever for you, like that. I think it was a Euripides chorus that like got them out of
I heard that story or a variation on it and I'd forgotten about it because it's so good. Yeah.
Yeah. I just love the idea of like, you know, like, yeah, I went, you know, I went to see Hamilton. Like, do you want me to sing that song about my, you know, I'm not going to throw away my shot? Because I think I know like most of the words pretty well. And
yeah.
Know, like that version of like, but it, you know, it, so it seems clear that ancient people really did care deeply about the chorus in a way that I think, you know, it's very easy for us to not, to ignore that and just pass on by. Like, let's get to the action. What's going to happen next? Who's killing who? What are we doing?
Yeah. Oh, I love that. That's so thrilling. I just, oh my gosh. I honestly, and I say it every damn time, but this is my favorite part of my goddamn job. It's so funny because sometimes I'll like go into a conversation and I'm just like, you know, I'm like feeling worn out or, you know, whatever it might be. I'm just kind of like, okay, you know. And then as soon as I'm in it, I'm like, well, this is incredible. Like, I'm learning so much all the time. It's never ending. It's fucking best. So this has been the best. But oh my God, this has been so much.
This has been so much fun. It was a delight to, and yeah, I very much enjoyed going off on all kinds of tangents about things, but I am sorry that it's going to make your work harder in the editing process. No,
honestly, I mean, for what I love the tangents. That's why I do this, because especially with academics, like, you're made for tangents. So I just like set it up and then just sit here and like smile and listen, and it's every time.
Excellent.
Thank you so much.
No, this such was a wonderful. Thrill. This was so much fun.
Oh, nerds, thank you all so much for listening. I do have to tell you that I had to cut out a whole bit about cocktails and ancient drinking games just because it did not fit with the episode and it was going to run too long otherwise. But oh, I have not mentioned this to Amy yet, so hopefully she's in for it. But I would so love to have an episode dedicated to cocktails about ancient myth, you know, especially with my book coming out, but also specifically drinking games at ancient parties, symposia, because they had a bunch of drinking games. And isn't that just the coolest fucking thing you've ever heard? Anyway, that is all to say, this episode was so incredible. Amy is so much fun, and I just absolutely loved talking Greek tragedy and Sophocles. And obviously we talked Euripides too, because how could we not? But just learning all these new things, having these new ideas of episodes that I can cover, all these different plays that I haven't visited before. It's just always so exciting. Such a reminder that there is so much content left for this podcast. It's never ending. The ancient Greeks were just really cool. I think that's the long and short of it, right? I mean, God, they are just really fucking fun people. You can find a quick list of all of the plays that we talked about in today's episode in the episode's description, just in case you want to look into them on your own. But also, you know, don't look too deep, because like hell if I'm not covering these on the podcast very soon. Thank you all so much for listening. You are all the best. I am Liv, and I love this shit.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.